I've had the privilege of being in Palestine about six times over the years. And that picture up there on the monitor is the Sea of Galilee. And Don Ann actually was on that trip when I was there. A group of us from the old Northwest Union went there and visited all different kinds of places, from Jewish settlements to Palestinian villages that were being harassed by those same Jewish settlements. And it was a pretty amazing trip. And we were out on the Sea of Galilee on a boat, and on cue the wind came up and it got really choppy. It was wonderful. It was like Disney was involved in somehow to make it this event. But I remember staying there on the lake shore, and if you close your eyes, you might experience it the same way I did. I could feel the breeze against my face and the sun on my arms. It was a warm day. And you could hear the waves lapping up on the shore and the sound of birds circling overhead. And I invite us this morning, as we think about this text, that we locate ourselves within the story and try to see, feel where we are in the context of Jesus doing some teaching and calling us to think about what does it mean to know and follow him. Last week we wrapped up Luke chapter 4, and by now in our study of Luke, Jesus has overcome the tempter in the wilderness. He's managed rejection by his own kinfolk and his neighbors, and he's launched into a healing ministry where he's touching the lives of people in need and preaching the great news of the kingdom to those who need to hear it. And as we get to chapter 5, Luke stitches together the story. Excellent. The crowd is building. You can feel the anticipation. Try not to push too hard against me, okay? Gotta have some room. There's actually four of us down here. Thank you. There we go. Jesus loves all of us, including the studies, I think. So, but there's Jesus. Thank you. Good Lord. Now we should take the offering. What a fun group. Just don't cause any trouble. Anyway, Jesus is there on the lake, and he is, as far as we can tell, by everything we read in the story, he is an amazing storyteller and a powerful preacher. And everywhere he goes, crowds gather just like this, and they gathered around him. And there was something about his message, it seemed, that both warmed the hearts of people, but also just about made them feel like they were going to ignite, right? There was something, he had a fire about him. And there was something about the way he both comforted the disturbed and disturbed the comfortable, as we've talked about that before. And for lots of us, he did both. Lots of us, he does both. He comforts and he disturbs us. And so in this story, for whatever reason now, he leads this group down by what's called Lake Gennesaret, which is also called the Sea of Galilee, which was the locals' name for this body of water, not the Sea of Tiberias, which is what the Romans called it when they had come in and occupied the land. The Jews are living under occupation there. And the Romans, this was their sort of Gulf of America, right? They renamed the body of water the Sea of Tiberias. They also regulated its use. Fishermen had to buy a lease to be able to go out on the water. They paid taxes on the fish that they sold. There was transport tax when they gathered their fish in to take it to market. So this body of water that had been the place where people just managed to get the food they eat for every day was now had been taken over by the government. Fish that they traditionally harvested for their own local consumption was now more and more being dried and sold and transported into the big cities for imperial use. That's the way the world works, it seems. So they had to buy into an economy just to survive. And so this is the story of Jesus coming into the world of economic distress. And he's talking to fishermen who were described by some people as the most miserable of professions. Fishermen have the most miserable of profession. Long nights out on the water, and again, so hard to be able to make an affordable living. But today, here at the lake, the crowd is so large, they're pressing up against Jesus, and they're backing him up to the water's edge. Now, those of us who are regular size, those of us who are regular size of people, often, I think Jesus noticed them, because often, abnormally large people stand in front of us and we can't see anything. I think Jesus had us in, he was concerned about us. And so he saw that there was a boat, two boats out there, and he called to a person named Simon. He said, he actually goes out onto his boat. He says, would you go out just a little bit so that he would be away from the shore? What that did was it allowed, again, the normal-sized people to see, but it also created a bit of an amphitheater. So his voice would carry across the water so that everybody could hear it. Because in a crowd so large, people are huddled together, it would be really hard for them to hear. Jesus loved the little ones, and so he must have sensed our frustration. And he goes and does that with Simon. Out of all the characters in the Bible, one of the most interesting that I think of is the crowds. The crowd. I think I've talked about this before, but I just love the crowd. They're not anyone who has a name. They're not the person who's centered in the story. And yet they're essential for us to understand what's really going on in the story. It's useful as you read the biblical text to watch and see what the crowd is doing, gauging their reaction to Jesus, noticing how they move toward him or away from him based on their own anxiety or their fear or peer pressure or whatever it is that's going on around them. How are they going to respond? How will the crowd respond? It's the same question we get to face each and every day as we think about following Jesus, as we wrestle with what it means to know and love him. It's interesting to me that Jesus leads the crowd to the edge of the water this day, because this is a place of baptism, a place of baptism, a place and a day of decision. Baptism, in its original meaning, had to do with being initiated into a way of life, an ongoing initiation into a way of life. So along being a moment in time where you get dumped under the water or sprinkled with water or however your particular church does it, it's really about being sinking down deep into the life of God. Now the thing about standing on the shore is that's a nice thing. It's an easy thing, right? I can stand in the crowd. Maybe I can get up close to Jesus. Maybe I can back away when I don't like it. Maybe I can hide myself behind Vivian if things are a little bit tense and I don't like it. But on the shore, I can listen. And I can even listen well. I can listen deeply. But I also, on the shore, can do all of this without cost, right? Without having to take action, or without standing out or needing to commit. So I encourage you all here in the crowd to think about, where are you on the shore today? How close are you to Jesus? What are you thinking about as you listen to him? Do you think about what he's talking about? The truth is, in this story, we don't have any idea what Jesus talked about that day. Nobody wrote it down or bothered to remember. Maybe though, it's because the real message is what happens after this. When Jesus tells Simon to take his boat and put it out into deep water. Now think about this for a minute, crowd. Peter's been out fishing all night long. He's tired. They haven't caught a thing. What would your reaction be if Jesus suddenly showed up as you were getting ready to go home and he said, take your boat back out and try it again? What do you think you'd say?
Okay.
That's not in the text, but that's a good answer. That's a good answer.
You're crazy.
You're crazy? Yeah, maybe. us, right? Okay, how many of you ever said that to Jesus?
Okay, random human.
Random human, yeah. Although you've come down there. You know, I guess Peter was, and he had already been down there. You were part of the crowd that followed him down there. But yeah, you might wonder about it. You might not be so sure or that eager to do it because, again, you're tired. And Peter is this expert fisherman. Jesus wasn't a fisherman. He was a carpenter at that point, right? Peter knew how to fish. He did it every day of his life. He had made his living doing it. And now Jesus shows up and asks him to go out deeper in the lake without even saying why. And it's not clear why. We don't know exactly why Jesus told him to do it. But then again, Jesus often asks people to do things that don't seem to make sense. And often, when he shows up in somebody's life, what he asks us to do is more surprising and disruptive than we thought it would, than we imagined it would be. Right? More surprising and disruptive than we imagined it would be. Now, I like Peter. And despite all of his faults, he kept putting himself in a position when he encountered Jesus where he tried to stay close, he tried to listen. And usually he responded the best way he knew how, which is all any of us can do, is do our level best. And especially in Luke's telling of the story, it seems that Simon had somehow met Jesus along the way. He had heard his teachings. He knew a little bit about who he was. He'd seen glimpses of God's power being worked through him, and so he was open to Jesus. And so despite all of his tiredness, despite all of his uncertainty, his lack of understanding, how does Peter respond? He says, "Because you say so, I will. Because you say so, I will," which to me is a beautiful statement of faith. Because faith is about action, isn't it? More than it's about what we say we believe or what's rattling around in our head, faith is about putting our feet into action, putting our hands to use, responding positively to God's call in our lives. So here's Simon putting his trust through his actions into Jesus and responding, "Because you say so, I will." This is a transforming moment in Simon's life. When a simple sermon by the lake becomes a moment in time where he now moves forward in his journey with God. It's a life-altering encounter with the Word that's made flesh. In Quaker language, we talk about a day of visitation when God comes into our lives and speaks to us in direct ways. And the question is, when the day of visitation comes, is what will you say? Are you going to say yes to God, or will you back away? And the Quaker understanding of this over time is, the more you back away, the more often you back away from Jesus when that day of visitation comes, the easier it becomes to do all the time. It's like we lose our muscle, we lose our capacity to respond positively to God. And the same is also true. The more we say yes to God, the easier it becomes to walk in the light, to be in unity with God. And so this is a day in Simon's life where he takes one step closer to becoming Petron, the rock. When Jesus changes his name from Simon to Peter, he says, "You are this rock that I'm going to use to build the church upon." And this is a time in Peter's life when he becomes just a little bit more sturdy, a little bit more grounded. He's not there yet. He's got a lifetime of work ahead of him. Simon hasn't yet died completely to himself. In fact, when Jesus dies, and Peter is dealing with his own remorse about having denied Jesus, what's the first thing Peter does? He goes and finds a boat, and he goes fishing. I think that's what we often do. We always go back to what's familiar to us. Right? We go back to what's familiar. Those old attachments have a way of hanging on to us. It's not that fishing is bad, unless you're a bad fisherman, but there's nothing in and of itself that's wrong about fishing, but it wasn't what Jesus had called him to. He called him to be to something brand new, in the move from the safety of the shore and the calm of the shallows, as we move into deep water, there's a sense of uncertainty. There's a sense of unknowing, of no longer being able to rely on our own strength and power. The wonder of it, though, is that on the shore, you only can hear about what's going on. It's a secondhand sort of faith. You miss out on the miracle, right? You're distant from it. When you push out in deep water, that is the place of miracle. That's where God shows up and does things beyond our capacity, beyond what we can do simply by ourselves. Now, this all has a happy ending to it, right? Peter goes out on the boat. His life is wonderful after that. Well, if you read the story, it's not quite that way. In fact, he has sort of a nervous breakdown. It's all anxious, and he's like, Jesus, go away from me. I'm a sinful man. This overwhelmingly good presence of goodness, this presence of life, shows up in his life and reveals something within himself that he knows needs to be fixed. And in that moment, he feels called to leave behind his vocation, leave behind the tools of his trade. He leaves his boat and his nets and all those things there, and now he's off on a 3-year mission, leaving presumably his wife behind. Peter was one of the disciples that was married. He leaves his family behind into this life of uncertainty for a time. What's interesting about this passage to me is not only does it change Peter's life, it changes other people's lives too. Because notice in the story it says that they pulled up their boats on the shore and left everything and followed him. There can be something transformative for a community when one person has faith, when one person is willing to take that risk. It can inspire the rest of us to act in greater faith and obedience. That's why we need one another. It's why we need people to share their stories of what is God's calling them to do. It's why we need to support each other in the things that we're wrestling with, to get clear on them and to act on them when it's time. So this wonderful little story, this fisherman becomes a follower into a life and a place and a way that he doesn't know exactly where it's going to go. He moves from being an admirer of Jesus to becoming a student of Jesus. Right? That's what it means to be a disciple, to be a student, to go where he goes, to do what he says, to learn what he's teaching you, teaching us. And over time, Jesus will not only change his name and change his vocation, but it will change the entire shape of his life. And the story ends with Jesus saying that he'll now be, instead of being a person who fishes for fish, he's going to fish for people. What on earth does that mean? What does it mean to fish for people? Any ideas? You're falling asleep here, my friend.
Maybe to find people who just need to be talked to.
Okay. So it's reaching out to them, sharing what you know. Okay, I like that. What else?
Oh, you were
raising your hand. You were tricking me. You have to watch this crowd. They're really tricky. Anybody else? Anybody else out here? What does it mean to fish for people?
Right,
I'm fishing for people then, aren't I? Yes. What does it mean to fish for people? We don't know.
To gather them,
maybe?
Bring
them in? Yeah.
To share that it's okay not to feel like you fit in and stuff like that. And bacon?
Okay. Yeah.
Find people.
Find them, right? finding people. Some people think that the allusion to being fishing for people has to do with some Old Testament prophecies about basically about fishing for those people who are oppressed and poor. And it's an opportunity to catch them with the hooks, is the way the prophecies read, and pulling them in, helping to overturn oppressive systems. Other people would say that fishing for people is really about enabling justice, about working towards a place and a life circumstance where people have enough, where creation provides the abundance to take care of people. Others from a more evangelical bent would say this is the opportunity for us to share the message of God's grace and to ensure that people are living in right relationship with God. I think that it probably encompasses all those things. And in fact, in the story of Luke, what we have is Jesus saying of preaching the good news of the kingdom. And it's an invitation to invite people into that life of union with God, where we begin to embody the beloved community, where we begin to exist in a way that demonstrates the reign of God has actually come near to us, that we are no longer captive personally or communally to systems that leave us alienated from God and one another. I think we're going to see that become increasingly clear over the study of Luke. Well, I want to invite us, as we take some time for open worship, to sit at the lake shore and imagine yourself where you are. Maybe you're out in the boat. Maybe you're sitting in the crowd. I want you to consider, I want us to consider, what is Jesus speaking to us today as we take a few moments of silence?